Welcome to the Boiler Room, an Arena podcast. We're your hosts, Santiago and Julia. And today, Julia, are we talking about targeting?
I'm so excited, Santiago. We're talking about targeting. As the illustrious leader of our data track during Arena Academy, you are the one who, you know, leads all of these folks, whether they are brand new to data on campaigns or whether they've been like adjacent to data on campaigns and are looking to learn more. You take them through 5 days of training so that they can go from learning everything about the voter file, win numbers, targeting, and to me, what is the scariest monster on this thing, but that's just because it's coming from a perspective of ignorance, is how to use SQL in coding and working through all of these voter file and data things.
I would say
you're pretty well aligned to lead this conversation about data on campaigns and targeting.
Well, I'm happy to share any and all expertise that I have. I also have a lot of help with the Arena Academy. We always have really tremendous trainers come in and help us with the data track. And so I lean on a lot of their expertise to stay current. You know, I got my first data job in 2010, and things have shifted a lot since then. 2010 was like when people really, I think, started to think about how to incorporate data into strategy. 2012, we hit it big and like data was like the coolest thing on the block. And since then, I think we've learned a lot of lessons, in some cases the hard way, on how to incorporate data into what we're doing. And so I think it's been really interesting coming here to Arena and getting a different perspective on how to truly integrate data into all of the different aspects of a campaign. And so excited that we get to dig into a little bit of that today. You know, and I think we want to set it up here at the top for folks who have maybe, you know, they're a campaign manager, and right now they're looking at, they have some spreadsheet that's in their inbox that is related to targeting, and they're like, you know what, that's the last thing I really want to do. I don't read spreadsheets, and it's just, I'm going to keep pushing that back as far as I can before I have to really truly think about it. And I think there's a lot of folks who come to Academy having that same sort of feeling, and was definitely a feeling that I had when I was first an organizer thinking about these things. And so it's a very common sort of feeling, I think.
Definitely. And I am more than happy to play the neophyte or the foil in this podcast episode of asking you all of the ridiculous questions that I'm sure a lot of people out there wish that they could ask a data expert or a friend or someone who has a little bit more knowledge in this field than they do. So I'm super excited to take the role of a beginner and take that mindset of how do we, you know, what questions can I ask you that maybe some of us out there are a little afraid to ask about that spreadsheet that's sitting in our inboxes about targeting?
Let's do it.
Awesome. So Santiago, I think there's a lot about targeting, but I'm going to go super, super basic to begin with. What do you think about when you think about targeting on a campaign? Like, what are we actually talking about?
When we're actually thinking about targeting on a campaign, you know, I think a lot of people will say, like, you know, maybe we should be talking to everybody. And in some ways we do, if we're doing TV ads, like those TV ads are going to be viewed by a huge audience. But we oftentimes think about like, who's the intended audience? Like, who's going to see that ad, get that phone call, see that digital ad or that piece of mail, and like, who is getting it and what action are we trying to get them to take based off of that? And there are various things that get mixed into that regarding messages or, you know, things that we might use to help us narrow down and make that universe a little bit smaller or customized, so that the impact of the contact that we're making with a voter is as high as possible. And so ultimately what it boils down to is, you know, making sure that there is a defined audience of people that we want to reach. We're taking some sort of message to them with the goal of influencing their behavior, whether it's increasing their likelihood to vote, increasing their likelihood to support our candidate or our issue, or maybe even increasing their likelihood to participate in the campaign in some way. all of those things do not happen in a vacuum. They exist within the context of a limited budget, a limited staff time. And so targeting is a tool by which we can prioritize what we're doing on a campaign so that, you know, maybe we don't spend time talking to a voter who votes in every single election and already has their mind made up of who they're going to be supporting. But we spend our time talking to the person who is less likely to turn out unless they get a reminder, or is less likely to early vote because maybe they haven't done it in the past. And so we're trying to change behavior, and it's trying to focus it in on an audience that we think might be impacted by that based off of available data, or people that we think we need to move in order to win an election. And those can oftentimes be the same thing.
I just want to give major snaps for that explanation, Santiago. I feel like that was so clear, and such a good level set for what this actually means. Because again, as we said at the beginning of this podcast, we're all about deconstructing some of this jargon. And I think that sometimes we begin to lose sight of what is the reality when we talk about things like targeting. And speaking of that, one of the other words of jargon that is often associated when we talk about targeting and data is this idea of a universe. So want to just ask you again, from this perspective of I'm the beginner, what do we mean when we talk about universes? How, like, why are they useful? Why do we talk about different universes? How do they get made?
So at the top, the universe is just a list of people. Like, it is, I mean, I almost prefer to use the word audience, because it's like, I feel like from that you can get a lot more specific about kind of the who, what, where, when, why of like, okay, what do we do with this list of people? You know, the universe is a very fancy, I don't know, I felt fancy when I first used it, and I was very excited about creating my own universe when I first was tasked with it. And it felt like it was carrying some weight when I was doing, like, actually in van, selecting all the different criteria for the people who were going to ultimately end up on a list that we were targeting. And so it's important to have a list of who you're targeting and being specific for, you know, about that. And it comes together in a few different ways. One, it starts very basic with the voter file. Who are the registered people or newly registered people who live in a district or geographic area where you're trying to win an election? And essentially is a list of criteria based off of a set of assumptions of who you're trying to get to take a certain action. So I think, at least for right now, one that people might be thinking a lot about is like, okay, what is a universe that we might use during a get out the vote phase of a campaign? And for that, it's like the intended goal is to get people to go and vote. And so we're going to use data that tells us a little bit about maybe vote history, or a voter model that tells us how likely is somebody to turn out and vote. And so that modeling data can be helpful in like getting real specific on like who those people are. So you can find the individuals. And so each person is scored from 0 to 100 in terms of what is their likelihood to turn out. And that's just a very basic like turnout model scoring. But all of that is based off of like vote history. So the score is made specific to the individual and individuals who look like them. So people in my same age range who are Latinx, mid-30s, maybe, you know, live in the burbs. We get a certain score.
You're giving some personal data.
I'm giving some personal information and data. I'll have a score. And people who look like me will be scored similarly in my kind of same geographical area, predicting how likely we are to turn out and vote. And so using tools like that, we can start to narrow down who we are going to be talking to. And I recently moved. And so, you know, here in Maryland, I might be what's maybe considered a newer voter. And so my turnout score actually might be a little bit lower than what it was when I lived in DC, and my voting record is a little bit longer. And there's ways that like they actually can see across states, but you know, those are gaps within voter data that exist that are real. But all of that data can be brought together within VoterFile. If you have some access to something like VAN, you'll be able to see some of this, but you can set that criteria and say, here's this list that we want to talk to.
I think that that's a really clear explanation of universes, and you brought up a number of important points within that. And just to call them out, you know, this idea of modeling is as one thing, but then this idea of, you know, you spoke about yourself as being sort of given your data points as being part of a general group, and therefore how we might think about targeting you, Santiago, and folks like you to do the thing that we want you to do or take the action that we want you to do. So a couple of things on here. Before we dig into the modeling question, because I have lots of questions about that, I want to talk about segmenting. So we often talk about these universes, which you just described as an audience. And then we talk about segmenting that audience or segmenting that universe. Santiago, why and how do we do that? What does that mean?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of different approaches to segmenting an audience that you can take. And I give lots of credit to my training partners, AJ Carl and Catherine Tarsney, because I feel like we've talked a lot about this in terms of like, how do we actually create universes and how big should they be? This is a question that we get a lot. People are just like, can be like, my universe is so big, like it's 100,000 people. There's just more people than I'm ever, and people will feel overwhelmed by that. And so one approach to segmenting a universe is just in terms of your ability to reach that given your organizing capacity or your capacity on the budget side to send pieces of mail to an audience. And so you can always just go purely based off of the scores and the data in there. But we oftentimes will teach campaign managers, data directors, organizing directors to think about what is the campaign's capacity to reach people. And we oftentimes will set up different scenarios for saying, okay, in scenario one, like what is the smallest amount of capacity that you might have to reach voters? And that becomes kind of your tier one limit of like, if we only had the ability to talk to 20,000 voters, who are the best 20,000 voters that we need to be able to talk to? Then there's like the medium capacity range where we're saying, here's if we had the ability to talk to 40,000, who are those best 40,000? And then 50,000, you know, if it's like another, if it, you know, money is no object and we can talk to as many voters as we want, you know, what is that third segment look like and how many people are in there? Within those, you can even segment a little bit further into like, what are the specific messages that we might be making of people or delivering to people, or the different asks that we might be making. And so those are different segments within, you know, kind of these set of priorities that you have. You know, here are these voters that we absolutely need to talk to because, you know, we think they're going to be most receptive to our message based off of either the modeling or the polling. But even within that, there's just the delivery of different messages and asks to them that is important to be able to decipher. And it can get overwhelming. And you can, I mean, a lot of campaigns will think that they need more segments than they, you know, segments for every single, you know, age group. Sometimes it's better to be a little bit more broad, but still being intentional about, okay, for this group, when we are trying to persuade them, you know, what is the message that might be, what are the two messages that we want to use in order to persuade people? And some people, it might be something like healthcare, because, you know, that's something that's going to be, you know, based on polling information that we've got, shows that that actually will change somebody's support behavior, versus for another group, it might be, you know, another issue around gun control or something like that for younger people. Who knows? I mean, those are just a couple of just random examples.
No, I think that those are such great examples. And I feel like that was such a good explanation of what segmenting is and why we do it, and sort of how there's so many factors that go into it, whether it's thinking about our resources. So, you know, who do we have the ability to reach? It's also thinking about what messages resonate with different groups of people, and thinking about that clearly and having it be based on data, those sorts of things. And then also just thinking about you know, what are the differences between a turnout message versus a persuasion message? So sort of who needs to be hearing what within your universe at different times in the campaign.
And one thing I want to just harp on for a second is that, like, when you think of a universe, and how we talk about it at Arena Academy is like, I always want to pull people to the fact that, like, the universe, this audience that we're trying to reach for different voters, whether we're persuading them, trying to get them to turn out to vote, register to vote, that's something that's owned by the whole campaign. Like, mm-hmm. sometimes I'll get the question from just the organizing director, and they've essentially taken that on, that, like, and think that organizing has to get every single voter who's in within that universe. And it's actually all of the pieces of, you know, whether it's communications, whether it's digital, whether it's all of those things coming together to figure out who and how we reach these voters. And I think people can get into a trap of feeling like they have to take it on themselves, especially if they're in organizing, and like that sets up unattainable goals for your organizing program. It can make your universes so broad that you're actually not being as targeted as you could be, just because you feel like that you own that entire win number. And you know, the thing that I want people coming away from Arena Academy to know is that, you know, it's all, everything working in concert together in order to achieve that goal. And so, you know, it's almost like you could do like a divide and conquer approach, where it's like, you know, for the small organizing team, here's like the audience that we really need you to talk to and have those more personal conversations with. And sometimes it's like, all right, we're going to send direct mail, we're going to serve digital ads, send a text message, and have a phone conversation with this person. And it's like all of those things like being infused together. And, you know, we just put up a tool on voter contact universes and planning that is based off of a tool that we use to kind of like layer and see what does our paid media universe look like versus our organizing universes. And it's like those two things like run side by side. And it's important to have a handle on like, what are those, when are those things up? When are we talking to voters so that they can work together?
I think that's so important. And it's something that I oftentimes tell organizers as well when I'm training organizers, is like, to alleviate that pressure, right? Have you had those conversations, Santiago? You've been an organizer before. When you get to the door and you talk to a voter, and afterwards you're just like, shit, are we allowed to curse? Darn.
Yeah, fuck yeah.
You know, that conversation didn't go as well. I don't think this person is actually going to vote for the candidate, or I don't think this person is actually going to turn out and vote because they feel like it's just not worth it. And to organizers, I say, you know, that's one touch. And ideally within the universes and the way in which the campaign is reaching out to voters, there are multiple touches. So this person might also be within the segment of the universe that's going to get a mail piece, in addition to, you know, a digital ad that's targeted at them. And so you as the organizer, you know, might have been sort of a third piece in there, the first of the three pieces. And that conversation that you had could have moved the needle, given sort of all of the things that might follow on that. So also like to say that as well, and I think it's a really good point. It's just, you know, organizing doesn't have to take it all on. We also think about universes and targeting when it comes to all of our paid media strategies, when it comes to many other things. So it's a really good point. Santiago, with the time that we have, I want to make sure we go into this topic, which is on modeling. And I just want to say that there are a lot of skeptics out there with reason, and a lot of folks as well who are just, you know, we talk about models for turnout, we talk about models for persuasion, and I think a lot of folks are saying, you know, why should we believe those models? What are they good for? What are they measuring? And so I was just hoping you could pull back the curtain a little bit and tell us a bit more about what all of this means, what information they're taking in, and why we should approach these models with healthy skepticism and a little bit of buy-in.
Yeah, I mean, plus one to the healthy skepticism. I think it's important. And one of the things that I hope that listeners of the of this podcast in general walk away with is it's good to have a healthy skepticism of data, and that's the way that data will get better, but also to still like understand what the weaknesses are of data and analytics, because I feel like there's like this infallibility of data where I would say pre-2016 was like the data is never wrong and like that was it. And you know, I think coming out of the 2016 election, I think there were a lot more skeptics or people who were previously skeptics now ready to say we don't need data at all. And I think that is I think tricky territory for us to be on. And so I would hope that hopefully through this election and in the coming years, we get a little bit more nuanced in our approach to data to say, it's okay that, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty when we're talking about models. You know, when we talk about it at Arena Academy, we always talk through this one example of like, okay, what does it mean if somebody has a score on a candidate support model of 75. So I mentioned earlier in the podcast, 0 to 100 is like the score range that we use for models. 0 is on a support model that's gauging somebody's support for a candidate. 0 is they're less likely to support. 100 is they're very likely, like almost certainly going to support our candidate. But everything within there is a probability. And so the example that we use is like, if somebody has a score of 75 and we talk to 100 people with that score of 75, out of those 100 conversations, we actually expect to have identified 75 people who support us and 25 people who don't. And so sometimes, and I remember this from my organizing days, when I would pull a call list for somebody and, you know, train that volunteer, they'd come back and be like, Santiago, I had these conversations and I'm talking to people who don't support us. You know, I had two conversations and I've identified two people who don't support us. That's actually something to be expected because of the way the probability and the scoring works. But the score helps us in determining who's likely to support us. So we have hopefully have less of those, you know, if we do our targeting right, we have less of those negative supports identified and helps us just prioritize and limit the amount of hopefully non-supporters that we're talking to or people who are already going to turn out who would otherwise would have voted in this election even if we didn't contact them. And so it's just a way of being able to make sure we're having conversations with the right group of voters to have the intended effect that we want. And I say the intended effect mostly to also highlight the fact that like whoever is a priority for your campaign or your organization, that's also an impact, like a factor in your the way you use a score. There are a lot of organizations who might be, you know, hyper-focused on turning out younger voters or, you know, communities of color. And the way that they use things like turnout models might be different. And that is due in part to some of the limitations of these models. You know, for communities of color, for younger people, it oftentimes will score on a turnout score, might score them differently than white voters because there's more data available on participation rates among white voters. You know, maybe the white voters actually haven't moved as much. And so those things can impact the way that somebody who is modeling turnout or modeling support, when they take in all of the voter file data, how they interpret and score that model. And so there's bias baked into that. And I think it's important for us to understand the limitations of data, the limitations of the information that we have access to, the way that we can gather it. These are all scores that are based off of surveys also. So all the criticisms that are out there about polling and how like, should we be able to trust the polls, things like that, that same data is being used to create the models, right? And so understanding that there's limitations in how we can reach people by phone, reach people according to the internet, those same biases that are in those systems get baked into the models that we create. Now, that's not to say, at least in my opinion, I don't think we should throw out those models wholesale because of their limitations, but we should know that those are the limitations so that if my priority is reaching out to communities of color, I can change how I'm using those tools. And then hopefully there's also just like a longer term discussion about in the progressive community about how we make those changes so that we can limit how much bias or, you know, how many limitations we have with our data. Some of that is long term and is not going to be solved in the next 90 or so days. And some of that are things that we can tweak around the edges, but both are needed.
Santiago, thank you so much for sharing that. I feel like it's constantly this conversation that comes up. And I actually do want to invite that and say, you know, for those of us who are thinking beyond the next 90 days, so we'll focus on these 90 days, use what the imperfect sometimes data that we have in order to do our best. But what can we do in the longer term in order to improve campaign data?
I mean, this is a tricky question. It's certainly a question I don't have all the answers to. And I think one of the realities is like, there's data that the campaign creates, and there's data that the campaign sort of inherits from Secretary of State, mostly your voter file. And so the data that you get from the voter file from Secretaries of State is subject to laws in your state around what information is collected at the time of registration and what can be shared. And so in some respects, there's like lobbying your state Secretary of State or your county boards of election to include certain pieces of data or expand. I think about like, you know, kind of how do we classify gender? And it's very much on a binary at the state level. You know, what, you know, some states don't publish race and ethnicity data. And some states aren't allowed to. And so it just differs from state to state, locality to locality. But I would also say that like there's data that you collect as a campaign. And so, you know, whether it is a simple sign-up form, whether it is, you know, your donation form, there's a number of different inputs where your campaign is generating and collecting information on people. And to be conscious and aware of like, how can you also be a better actor of like the data that you're collecting? I think it's is important so that we're not feeding more bad data into the system. But that biggest like structural change that we can have here is, I think, as practitioners, as people who work in campaigns, like lobbying and like trying to get kind of either legislation passed or different directives from your like secretaries of states.
Well, Santiago, thank you so much for sharing all of this incredible wisdom, for sharing your perspective, and for helping us dig in a little bit more and understand what can sometimes seem like a very complicated, very exclusive, I think, sort of part of campaigns, which is this sort of realm of data and how we interact with it. So I'm super excited for the conversations that you are going to be having on this particular episode of the podcast. We have some incredible guests who are going to be talking to Santiago and nerding out just a little bit about all things data on campaigns.
Yeah, I'm excited for those conversations as well. Like I have one perspective on it, but there are so many other interesting and good perspectives out there. And so hopefully throughout this pod, we will have many more discussions on targeting and ways we make data better.
Awesome. Can't wait to dig in.
Thanks, Julia. In this episode on targeting, I wanted to talk with Anna Gilbert, who's an independent data consultant. Anna has a wide range of data expertise and has worked with Enroll America, Citus Analytics, and even outside of politics with Slate Magazine. She got her start as an organizer and understands how campaigns use targeting to talk to voters. She was most recently the deputy state director for Cory Booker's presidential campaign in South Carolina. And shortly thereafter, the state director for North Carolina with Organizing Together 2020. I'm most excited to talk to Anna about how she uses her data perspective in these non-data roles. So this conversation really is for campaign managers or organizing directors who are out there who don't have a data team member and are trying to navigate how to still have a data-driven campaign. And so I think there's a little bit that we can learn from Anna in terms of how she approaches trying to still be data-driven in non-data roles. So have a listen. All right. Well, I'm here with Anna Gilbert. Anna, thank you so much for taking the time on your Saturday afternoon. But we've been talking about talking on a podcast for like a long time, and now we finally made it happen. So thank you for joining us.
Happy to be here.
Yeah, I wanted to get a chance to sit down and talk to you about data, targeting, how we use all these different crazy tools to try to talk to voters. And you were most recently, were you on the Cory Booker campaign in North Carolina, South Carolina?
South Carolina.
What role were you on the Booker campaign and organizing together?
So I was the deputy state director. So I oversaw organizing digital and data, although we didn't have a data director, so I was the secret data director as well. And then for organizing together, I was the state director. So oversaw those teams and a few more.
That makes me really excited that you were in a non-data role and then secretly also a data person on your South Carolina campaign. Cause like, I think that's a role that a lot of people find themselves in on campaigns where they're wearing multiple hats. And again, is just one of the reasons why I was excited to kind of sit down and talk to you about data, you know, and thinking about, okay, how do you bring kind of a data approach to these roles? And before you were on those two campaigns, what kind of data roles did you find yourself in?
I've done a variety of data roles. I guess to like go back one or two steps, it's like I started as an organizer, like a lot of people in politics, or like technically I started as a paid phoner and they promoted me to be an organizer. I had to Google what that meant. So one notch down, I guess, but I did organizing work for a while, but found myself really drawn to the like why we were talking to specific people or like as a organizing manager or regional field director, we call them RFDs. I found myself managing my team very much in a data-driven way. So spending a lot of time looking at reports and talking to my team about reports. And then I moved over to data roles and kind of run the gamut. So I've been a data manager, a reporting director, a data analyst. For a while, I had my own firm, which is actually back to what I'm doing now, where I do data consulting, doing a variety of data management and reporting, basically whatever I think folks need. And I guess going back to the idea that I was a secret data director, there's a lot of organizations that don't have the ability to bring on a full-time data person. And so really being able to jump in and work with some like smaller nonprofits and help them build a daily report or build something that a data director might do to make sure folks have the data at their fingertips that they need.
Yeah. And so you really are bringing like a wide kind of breadth of data experience into your now consulting and previous like non-data roles on campaigns. How did that data experience kind of inform your approach to being a deputy state director or a state director?
Yeah, I mean, I think like in 2018, I started to see, I was consulting then, that there were a lot of new tools that were out there. We were starting to text people in mass in a way that I could look at the data and see that was really interesting. People were responding. It was clear that we were doing it quite a bit. There were new tools like Mobilize, which is a great way to sign people up for events. It has a really kind of like clean user experience. And I wanted to see how those worked on the ground. And so that's one of the key reasons I wanted to join the campaign. I was also inspired by Cory Booker, and I believed for us to win in 2020, we had to start as early as possible. And I think the kind of wild primary season allowed a lot of folks like me to really jump on a campaign and dig in, allowed us to really start to learn how to use those tools. And I just think that the tools we have, I'd seen the data, but when I got on the ground, I was incredibly impressed. I've become a huge fan of texting. Even pre-pandemic, I think it was a great way to connect with volunteers and voters alike. Post-pandemic, it is one of the tools that hasn't changed at all. Texting and phone banking is just something we can double down on, because you can do that safely from in your home. But it was really great just to be able to not just see the data, but also see the programs that were using the data, both in North Carolina and South Carolina, just like really making sure that these tools were being used as efficiently as possible so we could connect with as many voters and volunteers and potential supporters as possible.
Yeah. And when you're thinking about a tool like texting versus phones versus, you know, 6 months ago when maybe door knocking was on the table, like how does like the underlying data like of who you're trying to target, how does that change for you when you're thinking about the different ways that you can contact people?
I mean, I always think of targeting as like both efficiency, like campaigns have limited resources, like especially right now, campaigns have very limited time, but they also don't have an infinite number of volunteers. And so it's like really making sure we're using our time, we're using the enthusiasm that volunteers bring to the table as wisely as possible. And then I guess the second priority, in addition to efficiency, is really making sure campaigns aren't harming themselves or shooting themselves in the foot. So it's like, you don't want to reach out to someone who's hostile, for instance. Mm-hmm. Or if you do, you want to take them off the list, but you don't want to move the conversation in the wrong direction. And so you really want to make sure you're talking to the best possible people, and targeting is how you would do that. In terms of how it changes per tool, I always try to think about like the goal of campaigns, or like one of the things that's kept me in campaigns for so long is just like, I believe in just like the fundamental belief of democracy, of neighbors talking to neighbors about issues that are important to them and why they're going to make a decision, like who to vote for based on that. And so in thinking about targeting, it's like you and like how that compares tool by tool, so texting versus phone banking, for instance, you really want to think about like, how can we empower these volunteers or whoever is texting or calling to have the best possible conversations, the most sincere possible conversations. And one of the things I found is texting is a little more transactional. And so for texting, you want to find people that are maybe a little bit more supportive. So people that are maybe a little bit more likely to volunteer or donate or commit to vote early, for instance, since many folks are going to be voting earlier by mail this year. Whereas phone banking, you might want to go a little bit farther into your universe and talk to people that are a little bit, maybe not 100% on the same page as you quite yet. So persuasion conversations, because you're able to have a little bit more of a conversation. You can share your story. And so really kind of thinking about having a little bit of a broader approach to something like a phone bank universe, whereas texting would be a little bit narrower to people that are more likely to be supportive, that you can have faster, kind of quicker conversations with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it strikes me that, like, especially if you are leaning on volunteer resources, thinking about the experience of the volunteer, you know, and trying to get them to come back in for a shift, that, you know, that also impacts, you know, again, like you said, making sure that, you know, if we're texting, what kind of conversations are they going to be having, and what are people primed to kind of to talk about, and are they going to be enthusiastic or are they going to be hostile? And that actually kind of brings up something else that I think is interesting in terms of, you know, because sometimes I think in targeting we just kind of get stuck on like, hey, here's this set range for your turnout universe, for your persuasion universe, and like that's kind of, it feels very cookie cutter. And I think what you just mentioned is a little bit more tailored to the different method. And like you said, like you maybe go deeper into a score if you are using one tactic versus the other. I'm interested in terms of your experience in the primaries. How did that like persuasion versus turnout, like how was that different from how you've maybe thought about targeting before?
Good question. I mean, I would say for the primaries, but I also think this is very true for a lot of down ballot races not in the primary, that there's a lot of education that could go in both turnout or persuasion. For the primary, I mean, in some ways it goes to persuasion, that the field was so broad. Even though I was working for like a popular U.S. senator, not everyone knew him or knew everything about Corey's bio. And so there was a lot of education just before you can make the persuasion of why to support Corey, my candidate at the time, for instance. But then there's also education in terms of turnout, of just like election day in South Carolina was on a leap year. It was on February 29th, a Saturday. And so just education of just like as part of turning people out, really educating people when the primary was and why it was so important. Does that start to answer your question?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's like, especially that notion that, you know, when we traditionally think of like persuasion, it's like, oh, how are we going to flip these Trump supporters over to be on our side? And I was like, actually, there's actually maybe some easier, you know, types of persuasion conversations that we don't necessarily always think about, just to raise awareness of who our candidate is and get people, you know, important election information that might get them to turn out when they otherwise maybe wouldn't.
I mean, I will say one of my surprises from the primary is so when I worked as an RFD, I was in Ohio in a very red area. It was called the Ring of Fire, or at the time, Representative Boehner had part of the region. So it was pretty red, but it was one of the areas that was critical to Ohio, that like while those counties were going to vote majority Republican, the like size of the majority would make a like significant impact in which way Ohio went. And so I'm like a big believer in persuasion. I'm really proud of the program my team and I ran, the Ring of Fire, back in 2012. And so coming onto the campaign trail in 2020, I was really eager to do some similar persuasion work of really thinking about like what kind of persuasion will work that we can start to learn by canvassing. We kicked off canvassing in August of 2019. I wanted us to have a competition of who had the hottest canvases because we were canvassing in August in South Carolina. But Nevada chose the phone bank that day because it was like 90 or 100 or something. So anyway, that's not important. But we kicked off canvassing very, very early and I was really interested in trying to run a persuasion program similar to what I had experienced in Ohio. But it, like, the reality struck me pretty quickly, and our analytics director also helped me kind of see this, but just like persuasion in a primary is so vastly different than persuasion in a general that like there wasn't a message that like me or like a canvas or like another canvas or getting someone to go from one Democratic candidate to another Democratic candidate that where that lesson could parallel like the R versus D, which I think just speaks to your point of just there's so many different types of conversations that can be had. And there's like, we always think of persuasion as like red, like R versus D or like red versus blue. But the reality is it's like, there's a lot of just like education and name recognition, or if you're in a primary or a different kind of district or a state that's not as partisan, that there's like, you might call it persuasion technically, but it also, it may not be nearly as harsh as what people have in mind.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I'm always thinking about the data, like the campaign staff who are new, who are like, you know, feeling maybe overwhelmed by data. They are not a data director. They don't have a data director. What are some of the things that they should be thinking about as they're kind of putting together their voter contact programs and trying to see like, is what we're doing working? Like, how do I make the judgment call that like this type of persuasion conversation that I was hoping to replicate or that I heard so much about somewhere else, like, is that actually working? Like, how do you approach that? Or how would you, you know, recommend somebody try to make sure, you know, kind of evaluate the success of their targeting?
Yeah. Okay. Well, before answering that, I want to give like my pitch for like my belief that everyone on a campaign is a data person in one way or another. And the analogy I always use is I think the digital teams have done a really good job of moving from like when they were called new media to digital to now like everyone is like a digital organizer, even pre-pandemic. Yeah. It's just like our fundraising is so online that like many, if not all parts of campaigns really identify either parts of their role or their favorite, like every part of their role is seen through a digital lens. I think data is not quite there yet, but I think it is very, very close where if you are working on a campaign, you are looking at a report that's being sent to you on a daily or weekly basis, you are looking in VAN where they really, really upgraded some of the reporting features that like, you are data driven. You are making decisions that are based on data. And even though you don't know like the back end of the database or like you've never heard of any coding language, it's like, I think very, very possible that you are using numbers to guide your job and make better decisions or understand kind of like your story of success or how to prioritize your to-do list in a way that is very data driven. So like, that's my like, I think like data teams are incredibly valuable and we're not going to disperse throughout the campaign, but I think because of some great tools that are available, like the reporting feature I mentioned in VAN or some like great like structured reports that are being sent out that like more and more people have the data they need at their fingertips where they like as stakeholders or as organizers can be making data-driven decisions.
Yeah.
Can and should.
And I think on that, like, it's also like even just having, you know, kind of a data framework to, you know, if you're thinking about the beginning stages of a program and you're not thinking about data, you know, you start to miss like, how are we going to track this? How, you know, who's responsible for the data entry? Or how do we just make sure that we're using tools that can, you know, help us capture what is happening from these conversations? And if you do have a data person and you're using that kind of framework, it also can help you better work with that data person and, you know, have a better relationship maybe with them, but also like just make sure that you get what you need when you need it. And I think that's something that can also just help people in that collaboration.
Yeah. In terms of like folks using the numbers they have to inform targeting, it's like, I really encourage anyone really to be looking at the data they have at their fingertips. So like organizers are going to be provided with a progress to goal report of really taking some time to like look at it and digest it and see how you're doing compared to other regions and to use it to really help prioritize and learn from others. And other regions doing a great job. look up what they might be doing, or listen to them a little bit more on calls, or use it as a time to celebrate them as like the starting point. I think another bit of data that people have at their fingertips is just like keep referencing Van, which is one of my other takeaways from 2020, is just that like Van has really stood the test of time and has really grown in a way that's still useful. But looking at like Canvas results at the end of the day, that maybe you had a phone bank and a bunch of volunteers came back and they're like, this list is bad. What is your universe? There's tons of round numbers, and you pull up Canvas results because you always check that every night, or you're starting to check that every night, and you see like, okay, like every volunteer got 3 round numbers, but that's consistent to what we always see, that like those are the like the memories or the stories that they are sharing, or those are the like harsh calls they had that were more like stood out in their minds. But like you as like a data-driven organizer are using some of the data at your fingertips to be like, okay, our universe is fine. Like, we know we're going to have some wrong numbers. It doesn't mean it's a bad list. It just means like that is part of running phone bank and phone making in general.
Yeah, I think holding that context and knowing what, you know, what you usually see in terms of either wrong numbers or contact rates is so important, because, you know, volunteers will come to you and like, this is, you know, the sky is falling sort of thing. And I've seen a lot of either organizers or regional directors like just pass that along, you know, and like that can cause, you know, just a lot of, just make things a little bit more hectic when they don't need to be, because you can like just pause and be like, okay, wait, is this what we're expecting? How big of a difference is it? And I think that's important context to just make sure that you have, you know, before screaming fire.
Yeah. I do think like one of the things I worry about with data, basically like data and Twitter and just kind of like the pace at which information moves, is just like people have almost too much information sometimes.
Yeah.
And like going back to 2012, one of the things I told my organizers, which was not to watch the news, where I just told them like of course it was up to them whether or not they wanted to, but it was like, no matter what happens in the news, no matter like Obama's performance in the debate, whatever happens, your goals are not going to change. The number of voters we need to talk to win in Ohio is not going to change. And I think for this, like in 2020, it's even harder, where it's
yeah.
Like, we have, I think, as like a progressive community, a really great Twitter culture where people love to talk about like, I had a great phone bank, this volunteer said yes, that like, I think there's a lot of really amazing energy that can be built on Twitter. But there's also, I think, a lot of distraction of like Twitter and news alerts and just like lots and lots of like polls and really accessible data, which is, I think, great to educate yourself with all the information that's available. But there's also a point to which it's like, your goals are not going to change, or like, the universes and the targets of who you are calling, it's like they're going to change over time and they should be monitored of like, is this universe responding in a way that makes sense? But we're getting positive IDs and some negative IDs, and again, maybe some wrong numbers, but it's in a way that like we expect, that matches the polls and matches other checks, that like, I think it's like, it's good for organizers to be like, or anyone in the campaign to be very aware of all the information and numbers that's out there. But it's also, I think, important to not be too reactionary, and like have checks in place and make incremental changes, but not jump when there's like a couple small flags.
Yeah, no, that's great. Especially the not being distracted by, you know, the different publicly available polls or, you know, 538. Like, the thing I always come back to is like, it's our job to like, move it from whatever, you know, get us closer to that, to the win, versus what a poll is saying, where we are, where we stand right now. You know, and it's like, if we're getting distracted, we're not doing that work.
Yeah. I think, I mean, this is off targeting, but I think a little bit about election day, where we're all going to be in our own bunkers. Hopefully many people will become poll workers, for instance, but for the most part, it's like, everyone's not only going to have kind of their like traditional war room, but you're also going to be quarantined. And so it's going to be a lot of people alone looking at like Twitter and information that's available. And I think it's even more important for people to really have a plan and like stay focused, that like, of course we should always like be mindful and pivot if needed, but also like everyone is in their own kind of independent place, that like not everyone should be pivoting at the same time.
Yeah. That's also my pitch. Almost also my pitch when people are in those boiler rooms, to be nice to your data people, because they also, they don't have access to any other special information. They're like, I remember throughout the day during like GOTV, people were like, are we winning? Like, I'm like, I don't know. I don't have any more information than you do, other than like Or do we have volunteers coming in and walking packets? Like, I'm like, that doesn't tell me anything about the actual result.
Yeah, just one day only, you need to be able to predict the future.
Yeah. So be kind to that person. Send them, I don't know, send them a bottle of wine in the mail or something. I don't know how we can get them treats.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for taking your time to chat with me. Do you have any like last words of wisdom, especially for the now deputized campaign manager, organizing director, who's now, they're now a data person, as you mentioned earlier in the interview. Any words of wisdom for them as they're thinking about how to kind of approach things with the data lens?
Yeah, I mean, I think like everyone is a data person, as we've kind of talked a little bit about on this podcast. And I think like with that, people also really need to know way more than you think you do. And like part of what has enabled me to work in data is really understanding the program, which I understand because of my time spent organizing and as an RFD, and really like knowing the program, knowing how a phone bank is run, for instance, makes you even more powerful with the data that you have at your fingertips.
That's awesome. And like, especially if you are, now you've been deputized, you're a data person, you're an organizing director, knowing how a phone bank is run, like that's your bread and butter. That's what you do. Like, you know, you can have that context that maybe somebody else who's just looking at the numbers doesn't have. That's great advice. Thank you for, again, being with us, Anna Gilbert, and be excited to talk to you again on a whole variety of, we have a whole list of things, I think,
great,
that we like cooked up a few months ago in an email you and I had back and forth. And so hopefully we get to talk to you again on this podcast. But thank you so much for taking the time.
Yeah, it was a great chat.
My next interview is with Kate Dahl. She's been working in progressive data and analytics in the technology space for a better part of a decade. She is most recently an independent consultant, but she's held management senior data and analytics roles at Organizing Together 2020, the DNC, for Future, and Blue Labs. I met Kate when she was on the data team in Pennsylvania in 2012 for the Obama reelection campaign. And I wanted to talk to Kate because she's a reporting expert. And our conversation really centers around a topic that's strongly associated with targeting, but that we actually don't talk that much about when talking about targeting. And the two are so connected. And it's, how do we evaluate our targeting? How do we see if our programs are working? So have a listen. All right. I'm here with Kate Dahl. Kate, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us to talk a little bit about targeting and reporting.
Yeah, I'm excited.
Yeah. You've been somebody that I've worked kind of, you know, tangentially with for a long time. But for the folks listening, talk to me a little bit about your data background. What is your strengths? What is your, I don't know, your superpowers when it comes to
superpowers.
Data?
Yeah, my background, I mean, just like you, I come out of the world of Obama. So I was very lucky when I graduated college. I had a friend who was kind of my big sister that I went to college with, and she worked at the DNC when I graduated. And she knew that I wanted to get involved in campaigns and politics. And she was like, but focus on data. Like, data is where it's at. Data is where you can like learn a lot and grow a lot. And she was like my big sister. So I just did blindly whatever she told me to do and ended up doing data for the Obama reelection campaign in 2012 in Pennsylvania. And fell in love with it. I mean, like, campaign work is exhilarating and fun. And somehow behind that, I also got to use a lot of math, which like lined up with my interests, and followed through with all of that into my career as it is today. So I've worked all over the place. I worked for Enroll America during the first open enrollment cycle. I worked for Blue Labs, which is an analytics vendor. I've worked at the DNC. I've worked for Super PACs. And I think kind of the consistent thread line, my bread and butter, as you would say, is reporting and infrastructure. I think everything that has to do with program needs to have some kind of understanding of what the program is behind it. And that's where data can be really powerful. You can pull numbers out of VAN and spend a little bit of time processing them and analyzing them, and then suddenly have an idea of not only what you've done, but what you should change and what you can do in the future. And tell that to all of your different audiences in coherent and pretty way with data visualization. So I could talk about reporting, like, days old.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned reporting because, you know, and I've talked to you about this before, like in our trainings, when we're talking about targeting, it's usually towards the end where we mention, hey, you're going to have to report on all of this. You're going to have to be able to show like the work that you've done and be able to see if this is even working. And so I'd love to talk to you and dig in a little bit on reporting and those tracking systems and like, what do we need to even be doing or what systems do we need to have in place to be able to do reporting?
This makes me think of, I feel like everyone who's ever done organizing has thought of this adage, if it's not in a van, it doesn't exist. Yeah. So, you know, the reason that a field program or a texting program or what have you has data capture is so you can understand what's happening on the ground. You know, the conversation is incredibly important. And I think the qualitative nature of that conversation is hard to capture in data, but you can still capture some of it. You can capture, you know, whether you talk to someone, you can capture their IDs. So if you're trying to talk about a candidate or an election, you know, is that person supporting your candidate? Is that person leaning towards the party that you're supporting? If you're trying to find volunteers, is this person even interested in volunteering? And all of that information can both help with like future targeting programs. So if you want to go back to people and target them again in the future, knowing that someone said that they support someone or that they want to volunteer is so much more powerful than just a model saying they might support. But it's also helpful to evaluate, are you even talking to the right people? So if you're trying to knock on doors in a neighborhood and you keep coming up with people who say that they're supporting a Republican or supporting a third party candidate, and you had built all your targeting around them being likely supporters, maybe there's something wrong with your model. Maybe there's something wrong with your targeting, and you might want to go back to square one when you create your universes for targeting.
Yeah, absolutely. That leads us to the kinds of reports that we're using. Like in your experiences, you know, looking and working with different campaigns, like what are some like common either not reporting mistakes, but like things that either make, you know, we're looking at the wrong metrics or just makes a report not as useful? Like what are the different things that separate, what separates a good report from say a bad one when trying to evaluate a program?
Yeah, I certainly don't want to say this isn't an important metric because it is. There's so much focus and so many reports on attempts and just getting a really, really big number, which people like big numbers. It, you know, shows success. It shows program growth. It's important. But an attempt, you know, if that attempt is made up of a bunch of wrong numbers or not homes and you're not actually talking to voters, is it really, you know, moving the program forward? So I actually think, you know, conversations always should sit side by side with attempts, making sure that of the, you know, output that you've created, how many of those attempts actually generate a full conversation? How much data capture are you doing there? And so conversations let you see contact rate, which can then go into productivity. Are there areas where you're having low contact rates? Can we understand more about that? Is that through, you know, an individual canvasser or is that across the program? And using that information, as much as you're able to tell your big loud story with attempts, you also want reports and data to inform how you can make your program better. And you can start to think about how you get contact rates up, how you get better data capture, all that good stuff. So I do think there's an overemphasis on attempts in a lot of reporting. And I don't think that it should ever sit alone. It should always sit next to what was the actual productivity of what your canvassers have been able to do.
Especially when you're using tools like a dialer or something like that. Like,
oh yeah.
Attempts almost become moot at that point, you know? Like it's like,
yeah. And from a data perspective, dialers are really interesting because dialers, you take away the actual human dialing into the phone. And so the attempts aren't even attributed to a person anymore. Yeah. It's just attributed to a robot.
Yeah.
So the conversations really are where the bread and butter. It's where the important, both programmatically, the important work is being done, meeting voters where they are and having a real conversation with them. But from a data perspective, it's also where the data capture happens. It's where you get to, you know, get a bunch of meaty information and learn from it.
Yeah. And you mentioned something around the quality of the program and like digging into that and seeing that in the numbers. That like, to me, is like the most fascinating part of this, of like trying to make a program as good as it can be so that we can have the intended effect that hopefully these are high quality conversations. Can you talk a little bit more about how we try to assess like the quality of our contacts or scripts or and when we're looking at reports?
That's a good question. So I think quality is something that comes sort of hand in hand with training. So you can put someone down with a call script and instruct them to call through people. But if you don't actually look at the data that's coming back and try and understand, you know, how those conversations are going with voters, it could be a very sort of fruitless endeavor. So I think contact rate is a big, really big one. Finding tactics of getting the contact rate up could include, you know, looking at days of the week that seem to be more productive, that have higher contact rates, times of day. You know, that gets really nitty gritty, but depending on who you're trying to target, maybe it's easier to catch them after work when they come home, or maybe it's best not to call during dinner time because people don't want to be bothered on the phone during dinner. And thinking about those real humans on the other end of the phone and trying to find out how to reach them and have productive conversations and not just churn through your list is really important. Another one that I think I wish folks looked at more was ID capture. So sometimes you get these scripts and they have like 10 survey questions on them and a bunch of activist codes. And I love getting a lot of information, but ideally there should be one or two questions that are really integral to what you're trying to do. And are you getting capture of those IDs that you can better understand your program? Yeah. So if you're trying to get, you know, people to commit to vote, it's great if someone marks someone in van as having had a conversation, but did I learn anything from that conversation? Am I getting anything from that? And that's where I think capturing, you know, what your ID rate is on top of your contact rate is something I wish we saw more of, but could increase the quality of your program, because not only are you ensuring that people are having those conversations and making sure they're getting through the script, but you're also, from a data perspective, getting all of the information to be able to inform future program.
Yeah, I love that. And I think the connection to the training component is so important. It's like, so many times when I've been looking at reports and like diagnosing what's wrong, like, you know, it didn't mean like this whole scale change in the program. It actually just meant, hey, let's spend a little bit more time making sure our organizers, our volunteers, people understood what the script was and what we were trying to accomplish.
Yeah, it can be indicative of, you know, if there's poor data capture, it could be a training issue in that someone didn't feel comfortable talking about a certain element of the script. Yeah. And that's something that you can pivot with programmatically. You can change your script to make it easier to make a certain ask or talk about a certain thing. I know that persuasion scripts can be really scary and long and intimidating. And maybe we don't want to train people to read through three blocks of text. Maybe we make it a little easier for them to navigate that. So data capture, again, you know, there's so much that you can learn about it, and it doesn't necessarily have to be what do the numbers tell us about are we winning or not. It can tell us as much about, you know, are we making this a good experience for our canvassers to be able to have an effect on the voters that we're trying to convince their hearts and minds of.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's huge. And like that experience of both the person, the voter that you're trying to talk to, because at the end of the day, all this targeting is like in service of talking to people, but then also the experience of the volunteer who is, you know, or the staffer who's trying to execute this and have these conversations. Targeting and data can just be like very kind of lofty in terms of like the technical aspects of it. And I've always tried to push like data staff to like, let's do some voter contact. Like, let's see how this actually works. And like, what are we asking people to do and asking them to capture so that we can get that feel?
It makes a huge difference. It makes a huge difference asking a data staffer to sit down and go through a script. I remember in 2012 when I started this, I thought that it was so simple. You read the script, you capture the information, and that's the end of the day, until we had a statewide phone bank where we all had to compete. And it's really scary getting on the phone and talking to people or knocking on doors. It's really scary. My voice would shake and jitter. And think about that, you know, just exponentially across your whole program. Getting through a script is hard. And so what can we learn about that to make the experience just as fun and comfortable as possible, while also with my data lens on, you know, get all the information that we need so that we can understand, you know, the macro sense of what the program's doing.
And yeah, I think that's like, that's such a good point in terms of being able to, like you mentioned, kind of the challenges related to capturing like the qualitative data associated with different scripts. Like, I feel like there's like qualitative data related to both the conversation and like what kind of tone there was. I remember an old persuasion script that we used to do that we like, was we were doing the test in 2012, was like at the end of it was asking the the caller themselves, like, do you think this person will actually change their mind? It wasn't asking that you weren't asking the voter that, but you were asking essentially the volunteer that, and that points to like kind of getting at that tone kind of question. But then there's also like the qualitative of like, what's the quality like of the experience that the volunteer is having, and like, what are the ways we can try to listen for that?
I love what you said about the sort of canvasser assessment or the caller assessment of how the experience went, because it's almost like giving that volunteer or organizer the power to be almost like a sociologist, you know, reading someone's body language and understanding when they told me X, did they really believe in X, or were they just trying to get me off their doorstep?
Yeah.
And there's so much that you, just from looking at the data and looking at the numbers, that you can't quite get compared to the actual experience of going through the voter contact. And so I think the idea of having the canvasser assessment as well as what the voter said could be a really interesting way to learn a little bit more about your program.
Yeah. And I think, sometimes you don't necessarily need to be tracking that in van, but it's always a good thing to be like listening out for. And especially if you're checking out volunteers after they've completed a shift sort of thing, like that's quality information that like can help make just the program better. And, you're a data expert. You've done a lot of these reports, pulling these numbers from van, setting them up. What advice do you have for the non-data folks out there who maybe are feeling intimidated by looking at some of these numbers or thinking about data in general?
That's a great question. I think the first thing I would say is Vanna is a wonderful tool, and it makes it really easy to track so many things. And you can get very nitty gritty. You can track them as survey questions or activist codes or in events or code. I don't even know what codes are anymore, but codes are a thing that you can track. And I think if you're new to data, it's good to keep it simple. You know, identify a couple of metrics that are important to your program and think about how to track them consistently. And just look at those for a bit. And one thing that I think Van does do pretty well is it makes data, sort of this concept of capital D data, really accessible, because looking at a person's record in Van, looking them up in Quick Lookup and understanding what survey questions have been applied or their address history and all of that in one page is just like looking at a row in an Excel file. All of that information is associated with that one person. And as you start to think of the different ways that you can apply questions or activist codes, those are all just different types of data that you're applying to a given record, then you can start to wrap your head around, okay, well, now I want to look at multiple records that all have the same criteria, and create a list helps you create that universe or list. And I think it's just it's a good way to visualize the big picture idea of what data is. The way that I learned, honestly, is exporting things out of Van into Excel and just, thinking of what does data look like. I had to visualize it. And so playing with it in Excel and being able to filter it or scroll through and look at the different columns and the different rows and understand what's a column versus a row, that really helped me. And then from there, kind of the world is your oyster. If you want to break into data, if you don't want to break into data, knowing how to navigate Van is still a superpower. And still just having that ability to know how to create a list and know what you're looking for and find that group of people that you want to talk to or call or what have you, like, that's still super powerful.
Yeah. And something you said earlier resonated with me in terms of like, if you're feeling like you want to get in more into political data or campaign data, you mentioned earlier, like, this is a place where you can grow your skills pretty rapidly and there's a lot to learn. And like, that's something that definitely I've felt in data, and there's so much to learn, but it's also all accessible. And like, there's so many great people, in the space who want to help you learn, and like, there's just a lot of great people to learn from. So yeah
1000%.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time, and we hope to talk to you again, and thank you for sharing your expertise with us.
Yeah, of course. Thanks, Santiago. This was fun.